Okay, so in this session, we're going to run through some of the high availability technologies that have been improved or enhanced in 2012 R2, as well as the SLA components that you need to take into consideration when you're looking at your architecture. So we're going to talk about resilient infrastructure and supporting continuous services, the increased availability of applications and services, optimizing your SLAs and your infrastructure to meet those SLAs, and we're also going to talk about and give some demonstrations on Hyper-V replication, and then you're going to get in some labs about Hyper-V replica, but also Hyper-V high availability using SMB shares as a storage solution. Okay? So a lot of the challenges we're facing today or in your current environments are around maximizing your operational efficiency as well as application and service availability and deliverable. We also have minimized capabilities to impact of your environment. So if you have an outage, minimizing the impact that it has on your environment. We also are going to be looking at ways that we can reduce your planned maintenance downtimes as well as address the causes of a lot of your unplanned downtime. We're going to talk about ways to achieve higher availability of your servers and applications as well as services. And we're also going to increase efficiency and lower your TCO. Okay? We're going to really try and come up with ways and help you to lower your IT costs from a day-to-day perspective. So some of the features that we've been improving upon are around the failover clustering supporting the 64 nodes, the enhancements in your NIC teaming, as well as the Hyper-V replica upgrades, as well as guest clustering enhancements with shared VHDX files. We also have clustered shared volumes. We've got more products and solutions starting to use clustered shared volumes, as well as the cluster-aware updating and live migration technologies. So failover clustering, we have massive scalability now with that 64 physical hosts in a cluster and over 8,000 VMs in a cluster. We have cluster dynamic quorum configurations where we can do node or node and disk majorities or file share witness quorums as well. We can plug into either iSCSI, Fibre Channel or SMB storage for your Hyper-V clusters. We can also reduce AD dependencies on booting clusters when the domain controllers aren't ready. So for those of you that insist on building domain controllers as virtual machines on your cluster, okay, becomes a bit of an issue if you try and boot a cluster when the domain controllers aren't up yet. So with 2012 and R2 especially, the dependency of those domain controllers being up during the boot of the cluster has been lessened, to say the least. We've also got the processes to drain the nodes automatically for you, as well as shut down the physical hosts. So in a cluster dynamic quorum, in node majority, we're counting the votes of all the physical boxes. Okay? So as long as you've got an odd number of servers, the voting works pretty well. Okay? But when we start adding the fourth or the sixth node into a cluster, we start running into some issues. So SMB transparent failover. So when we look at the way that we can use SMB shares for applications or Hyper-V, this is an example where we have a SQL server connecting to an SMB share. So the share is foo share. Okay? The database is sitting on the storage behind that SMB share. So the SQL server is connecting to foo share, which is going through the server on the left. The server on the left all of a sudden has an outage. Okay? It goes offline for some weird reason. Okay? It could be a hardware issue, network issue, whatever it is. When that failover occurs, the share connections and handles are lost temporarily. Okay? We're talking a very small period of time, microseconds or milliseconds. When the connections are reattempted by the SQL server, the connections go directly to the other server. Okay, so there's smarts in the technology behind the SMB shares, in the failover cluster for the SMB share, that say when the other node's offline, redirect the next retry to another node in the cluster. Ensure the optimal one of the other things we really need to do is make sure that the nodes and the VMs are evenly distributed and the workloads are distributed evenly across those nodes. So we have our Hyper-V hosts with VMs on each node. We can set up affinity rules to dictate which VMs can go on which hosts. Okay? The last thing you want is two nodes in a VM cluster going on the same host. Okay? There are certain workloads you're going to want on specific hosts and not have them cross over onto the same host. So we're able to set those affinities, and we can also set up anti-affinity class names to help make sure that the VMs stay on the nodes that they should be on. So upon a failover, so one of the physical hosts goes offline, the VMs are automatically distributed across the hosts that are remaining online. And the way that those VMs are distributed will be based on the rules that you've configured around affinity and which VMs can go onto which hosts. Okay, so you've got owners, and there's a whole range of different settings you can set to dictate which VMs go on which hosts in a failover. So as you can see, once it detects that there is an anti-affinity, okay, to make sure that the VMs stay apart, that should be staying apart, if for some reason the VMs end up on the same host, it will automatically correct the situation and move that VM to another node. High available DHCP services. One of the reasons why a lot of service providers never used to use DHCP in their data centers was because there was no high available solution for DHCP from the Microsoft stack. In 2012, we introduced highly available DHCP servers. So we can now have multiple DHCP servers so that we can now successfully, if we lose a DHCP server, we have another DHCP server that take the existing leases and continue issuing new leases. So it uses a failover setup consisting of at least two servers, and they can be located across different geolocations if you like, or they could be in the same data center. So if you're worrying about DR solutions and things like that, you can actually spread your DHCP servers across those multiple sites. The hot standby DHCP server failover can be designed in a hub and spoke. So like you see on the slide at the moment, we have a central DHCP server, and then we have a primary site 1, 2, 3, and 4, which could be different data centers, different locations, or in the same data center but different racks, etc. We can do load sharing DHCP failover in a single site with a single subnet, or you can do multiple subnets. You can pretty much architect it in any way you would need. NIC teaming, as we said earlier, supports all vendors in the out of the box. Okay, we don't have to worry about mixing different vendors in your servers. Dynamic NIC teaming, again, dynamically load balance across your teams to make sure that the packets flow in the most efficient manner possible. Clustered shared volumes. A lot of work's been put into clustered shared volumes over the last two releases of 2012 to improve the performance and reliability and stability of clustered shared volumes. We're able to enable all servers in the failover cluster to access a common NTFS volume, which is what you'll see where we traditionally put our Hyper-V hosts or SQL databases. We're able to provide a layer of abstraction above that NTFS layer. We're also able to provide application complete abstraction with respect to nodes actually owning a LUN. We can also now not have to worry about dismounting and remounting of volumes. So when a server fails, the next server takes ownership of the disks. We don't have to worry about the disks being dismounted, servers going offline, disks being remounted, and then brought back online. We also have faster failover times with clustered shared volumes because we don't have to worry about disk demounts and remounts and ownerships. With CSV improvements in 2012 R2, we've now got improved performance with block-level I.O. redirection as well as direct I.O. for more scenarios. Okay, so we're now looking at also more applications being able to use clustered shared volumes. So we have Hyper-V, we have file server clusters, we have SQL now using CSVs. We have a whole range of new products using clustered shared volumes, and I'm sure it's going to continue to grow that way. We also have clustered shared volumes and Windows clustering being able to be split over multiple subnets. So your Windows clusters don't all have to be on the same IP subnets. We can split them across multiple IP subnets or multiple data centers or multiple geolocations as well. We also have faster live migrations now with... We also have faster live migrations now with compression in this solution as well. Okay? So your live migrations of VMs from one environment to another environment is going to be much faster for both storage live migrations as well as just moving VMs between hosts using the same shared storage. So as you can see in the diagram, we do an IP connection between the two hosts. We configure the data, send it over to the new host target. The memory pages are transferred to the new host. The memory content and modified memory pages get sent across. The storage handle is moved to say that this host is now handling the storage for that VM, and the VM is online. We also have live migration compression, which means that we're compressing the memory that's being sent across the network. Okay? We're not just sending the memory as a whole chunk, we're now compressing the memory to try and speed up. We had some people asking questions earlier about it was taking a long time to do migrations. If a server was online, if the server was offline, it would happen faster. Well, with the compression capability now in R2, we're speeding that process up for live production VMs. This has also improved the performance of live migrations that occur over networks that are less than 10 gig. Okay, I still personally would recommend a 10 gig network, but if you've got a 1 gig network, we've enhanced the compression so that we can try and speed that live migration process up for you. Personally, don't do it over 54 megabits. As you saw in the demonstration earlier, Wi-Fi and live migration don't really mix. So, again, enabled by default, but will only operate if there is spare CPU. Okay, so live migration will try and use compression every time. If the CPU on the hosts are too busy, okay, it will start the initial live migration without compression. Okay, if your hosts are way too busy, you're not going to want it to try and take resources away from VMs that need it. So a similar thing, live migration with compression. You do the initial IP connection between the hosts, configuration data sent across the wire, memory content is sent across the wire, the modified pages are compressed before they're transferred, the storage handle is moved, and that VM is now live migrated to the other server. Live migration over SMB. So when we do live migration over SMB, we're utilizing all the available CPU resources on the host to do the compression as well as the migration. So we're using IP connections using the RDMA cards. Again, it's the same sort of process. We send the configuration data across. The memory pages are transferred at the highest speed. Because we're using RDMA, we're getting closer to 56 gig than 10 gig or 1 gig. The storage handle is moved over, and we've migrated across. Cluster-aware updating is one of those great advancements in technology that I've been waiting for a little while for. It enables us to update clusters in an automated fashion. Okay? Previously, if you had a cluster and you wanted to patch it, you would have to drain the workloads off the node, patch one server, bring it back online, migrate VMs off another server, take that one offline, wait for them all to migrate, power it off, reboot it, come back online, then do the next node, the next node, the next node. It was a manual process, took a lot of time and effort from an engineering perspective. With cluster-aware updating, we're actually allowed to now schedule an outage. We schedule when we want it to update a cluster. The system will automatically drain the workload off one server, patch the server, bring it back online, drain the nodes from the next, drain the VMs off the next node, migrate over, update it, bring it back online, and continue through the cluster until it completes. And the system automatically logs every update that's done, any failures that occur. If it gets partway through the cluster and it detects too many failures, okay, it will stop. It won't keep going through the cluster trying to update every node, even because it's detected that there's a problem. It's occurred too many times. We'll just stop and wait for someone to come and find out what the actual issue is. Yep. So out of the box, the Windows Update service is designed for, the cluster we're updating is designed for Windows updates and application updates. You can customize it to do third-party updates as well. So there's two modes. We can have self-updating mode where it will automatically go to Windows Update, pull down the updates that are available. It'll scan all the nodes in the cluster and pull down the updates and then start applying them. Okay. What it does, though, is when it does that, it gets each node in the cluster to pull down the updates that that node needs. Okay. So this solution will also make sure that all your cluster nodes are at the same patch level. Okay. I've had a couple of people talk to me about that after a while they'll run the validation wizard on their cluster after it's been running for a while, and they'll find that there's updates that aren't on one, that are on the other, and it fails the test. If you install the failover clustering wizard, or clustering aware updating, and run the wizard, okay, step it through, schedule it, it will make sure that your update, all your cluster nodes are kept up to date, and they're all at the same patch level. It will alarm and alert you to say if nodes aren't at the same level, and it'll tell you how to fix the issue. Yes. So
then WSUS will
feed
in the configuration manager, which gets
you
an even richer set of capabilities
for third
party updating and maintaining
updates. Yep. So yeah, there are multiple ways we can configure. So the comment is really around we can use cluster aware updating to talk to both WSUS and config manager, because if you're already licensing the System Center suite, you get config manager as part of that licensing in that suite. So you might as well deploy Config Manager, which then gives us an easier process to deploy updates from other third-party products. Okay? Again, you can use Windows Server Update Services or Config Manager, or you can also get it to go directly to the internet if you don't want to have any control at all of what updates get pushed out. Okay? Highly recommend WSUS as a minimum, and preferably Config Manager if you've got other third-party apps you need to update as well. So, as I said earlier, moves all the application off the node in the cluster, updates that current server, then it'll shuffle the workloads off another host, apply the updates, shuffle the workloads off another host, patch it, and then it'll eventually go through all the nodes, move all the workloads, patch the last one in the cluster, redistribute the workloads. And we're done. So some of the other options you have is if you have third-party plugins, we can store them on an SMB share and therefore be able to push out the updates from there as well. So we're going to be looking at increasing availability of your apps and services in your environment. So we're talking about Hyper-V replication, whether it's internal in one data center across multiple centers. We're going to be talking about SMB3 application support in a bit more detail, as well as guest clustering enhancements around shared VHDX files, as well as streamed backup. So Hyper-V Replica, we're talking about giving you a solution that is out of the box, free, no additional charges, to be able to replicate a virtual machine from one server to another server or to another location. Okay? It will replicate the whole contents of that virtual machine, the disks, the config, everything. and you can automatically fail over. So if you chose to, you can have a VM on data center A or primary site, and you can have a secondary site. And if something happened on your primary site, you could automatically bring up the server on the other site. All you literally have to do is hit the failover button, and that server is now online in your DR or secondary site. The configuration for replication, we can replicate every 30 seconds, 5 minutes, whatever time period you want. The replication is secure. We can configure it to use SSL certificates, so you can even replicate to servers not even on your domain. And that is what you're going to do in one of your labs, is you'll go through and actually configure Hyper-V replication using SSL third-party trust certificates. Okay? Prefer you don't use self-signed certificates. Self-signed certificates can be a bit troublesome because you need to make sure all the servers trust the root CAs. There is also the ability now to have a third replica. In Windows 2012, Hyper-V replica was limited to two servers. You can only replicate once. In R2, we're now able to replicate to a second site. So we can replicate to one server and then replicate from that server to another server. So you'll actually have three copies of the server, the primary, a secondary, and then a tertiary. So we have our initial replication, which goes across the internet or WAN, whichever you have, to your secondary site. Once the replicated changes have occurred, okay, the replication frequency kicks in. So once you've done that initial big replication, only the delta changes are synced. Okay, so it's only what's changed on the server. Upon the site failure, all your VMs can be started on that secondary or tertiary site. No, the faster the link. Okay, so the question is there a requirement for that link to be super fast, or can it be a 10 meg or 100 meg link? The speed of the link is only going to impact how long it takes to replicate. Okay, you could do it over a 1 meg link if you really wanted to, but it's just going to take a long time if it's a big VM. Okay, so the bigger the pipe, the less time it takes to replicate. Correct. So one of the other issues you may run into is if your pipe isn't fast enough and you've got a lot of changes occurring on the primary server, okay, if the pipe's not big enough, you're going to be waiting all the time and the server in the secondary site's not going to be up to date enough. Okay? So if you did have to fail over, there'd still be a fairly big difference between the two. Okay? Yeah. So if you're doing 1,000 transactions an hour, you're going to want a pretty decent pipe between the two servers. Okay? The initial replication doesn't have to go across an internet connection or an Ethernet connection. There are other options which we'll go through shortly. So once the site fails, as I said, we bring it up on the secondary site. We also have the option on the secondary site to bring it up using a different IP address. So if your DR site or secondary site is on a different IP range, you can actually start the VM on a different IP to what it is on the production site. So as I said, we're now able to extend the replication from just two sites to three sites. So we can now add, if you have two primary sites, we can now add a DR site as well, or you could have a second or third DR site as well. So the way the replication works is we would replicate from the secondary site to the DR site. Okay? We don't replicate from the primary to the DR. We go primary, secondary, secondary to DR. When we are setting up replication in a multi-tenant environment, it is highly recommended that we use trust group tags to identify who the VM belongs to. We should also start thinking about establishing different networks for different customers to replicate over. When we're talking about replication, we're not just talking about potential replication between your data centers. You can offer a DR service to your customers if they're running Hyper-V on their premise. So you could be the DR site or the replica site for their VMs into your data center. So you need to think about the technologies we're talking about and how you could create unique or good services and solutions you can offer to your customers to enhance their experience with you. And also, if you're struggling to get a customer to decide to go to the cloud, okay, and they're running it on-premise, a good option is to give them a potential trial edition of a replica into your data center, and you can start that VM in your data center in a test mode, okay, and you can actually run that VM live in your data center, and they can connect to it, see how it performs, and hopefully it'll perform better than what they're running on-premise, and you can potentially turn that potential DR option into a production option instead. Okay? Yep, question? So, yes. So the question is, does the client have to be running Windows 2012 on-premise? The answer is yes, they would have to be running a Windows 2012 hypervisor or 2012 R2 hypervisor on-premise. Sorry, one of the other things we need to think about also is the partitioning of the storage that you're storing the tenant's VMs on. So if you're replicating VMs to your environment, how are you going to isolate the VHDX files for each of your tenants? How do you identify it? How are you going to bill for the storage that you're storing all these replicas of VMs on? Okay, you really need to think about how you're going to do that isolation and billing capability. So we also have application storage with SMB3. So we can have that single file system namespace, and we can have all of your cluster shared volumes behind it on different storage solutions behind it. We have multiple arrays. We have that single location, and we can have our Hyper-V clusters and SQL Server sitting on top of that. We could also have your SANs behind that clustered shared volume to make sure we have a higher level of availability. So again, going back to having multiple different product offerings for your customers, not just cheap disk. We could have expensive disk options, or we could also have storage space options. Okay, so if you want to adopt the storage spaces technology, we can put that behind that solution as well. We also have inbuilt guest clustering support on Hyper-V so that your VMs can actually, you can create clusters inside those VM guest OSs. Those guest OSs can either have virtual fiber channel or iSCSI connections to your storage, or they could go to an SMB for storage. You have multiple options there for your cluster nodes in a virtual environment. There's full support for dynamic memory for guest clusters. So if you create a cluster on VMs, you can very easily use dynamic memory on those as well. So you can also live migrate your cluster nodes. So if you have a cluster VM, we can migrate the VMs from one host to the other. If the host that your VM sits on in a cluster fails, it will just move the cluster node to a cluster VM to another node, just like it would any other VM. And if your physical box came back online and you have all your affinity and everything else, ownership configured for the VM, it will move the VM back to that physical box once it comes back online. We also now have guest clustering with shared VHDX, which is new in 2012 R2. Okay? It means that we can create our guest clusters, point it to a VHDX file, which could either be a CSV, or the VHDX could be stored on an SMB share. Okay? Once the VM sees the shared disk, it sees it as a traditional shared disk, like it would see your SAN or anything else that you connected over iSCSI or Fibre Channel. Okay? The VHDX can reside on any type of storage that a traditional VHDX file can sit on. And we can support both dynamic and fixed disk. Okay? That clustered shared VHDX file can be either dynamic or fixed. I personally wouldn't be putting it on thin provision. Okay? So what we do is we create our guest cluster. We flick on the switch to say we're using a shared VHDX file on the VHDX file. And again, same sort of thing on an SMB share. We simply put the VHDX file on an SMB share, tell it that it's a shared VHDX file, and away we go. With clustered, so the question is there a performance benefit for CSV or SMB? There's no real performance difference between the two products, whether it's a CSV or an SMB share. It comes down to your network speed, the disks you have in those environments. So now we're going to talk about streamlined incremental backup. Okay, so improving the efficiencies of your backup solution. So integrated virtual machine backup capabilities means that we can now allow incremental backup of virtual hard disks. All your VHDX capabilities and incremental backups are all VSS aware. So backing up your VMware environment is far more easier. Your Hyper-V environment is now much more easier doing incremental backups. Both Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Friday, you can do an incremental backup. That was just to see if you guys were awake. Some of you look like you're dozing off. We also have the ability to save network bandwidth by doing incremental backups instead of full backups. Okay? We're also able to reduce the backup sizes because we're doing incremental backups. I'm sure most of you have been around long enough to know the difference between a full backup and incremental backups. So there is a downside that sometimes if you do incremental backups, you may have to roll back to the last known full backup and then reapply the incrementals. So you need to keep in mind the technology that you're using. Okay? So when we start looking at the system, so on Sunday we do our first full backup after enabling incremental backup. So we've got during backup we have a full difference one, and then after the backup we have a differences one. On Monday, before the backup, we have differencing one. During the backup, we have a differences one and differences two, and then after the backup, we have a differences two. Okay, so the first one's dropped off. On Tuesday, we do a second incremental backup. We have it start off with a differences two drive. We then becomes a differences two and a differences three. We merge them together and end up with differences three. Friday, we want to restore to Tuesday's backup. So what we do is we do an incremental restore. We restore, before the restore, we're running at differences three. During restore, we go back from differences three to differences two to differences one. Okay? And then that's where we're up to. So this is all Windows technology. We're not talking about... So the question was, what technology is driving this? It's a Windows backup technology. It's not a third-party product. Okay, this is all based out of the Windows OS.
Is this allowing file-level restores?
No, this would be a full disk restore. Sorry, I couldn't hear that question.
Yep.
So the question is, has the improvements in CSV and DPM meant that moving the ownership of the disks when you're trying to back up multiple VMs, has that been simplified or fixed? To be honest, I haven't done a proper evaluation yet of DPM R2, okay, because there's also the upgrades to the DPM service. I haven't played with the DPM R2 release enough yet to validate whether there's been a massive improvement or not. So I would assume there'd be a slight improvement. I wouldn't see a drastic improvement in the DPM R2 release. So we really need to also start taking into account what are your replication, what are your Hyper-V online backup solution requirements, what are your flexible storage requirements, what are your requirements to keep your environment up and running, what SLAs do you need to meet, do you need multi-node clusters, do you use single-node clusters and use Hyper-V replica for HA, what are your customers' requirements, and what are your requirements to meet those SLA times? Do you need DHCP failover? Do you want to take advantage of cluster-aware updating? Do you want on each server to be using LBFO and team nicking? Do you want NTFS availability? Do you want SMB and take advantage of some of the improvements of SMB? So optimizing your SLAs. So most of you in the room would be offering at minimum probably 99% uptime, but most of you are probably heading towards the 99.9, 99.99, or 99.9999. All right? Now, some of you may be thinking, yes, we're offering 4.9s or 5.9s, but there's some things that are changing in the landscape. So we'll run through that right now. When we look at 99% uptime, we're talking about 361 days and 35.35 days of uptime. So that's fairly easy to meet, okay? When we start looking at 99.9% uptime per year, okay, we're looking at 8.6 hours of downtime. When we look at 99.99%, we're talking 56 minutes of downtime a year. And when we look at 5.9s, we're talking about 32 minutes of downtime in a year. Okay? Now, one of the key changes we're seeing in the industry is a lot of service providers over the past couple of years, or as long as I've been doing service provider work, is seeing service providers say we're offering 4 or 5 9s excluding scheduled outages. Okay? So you could be offering 4 9s, 5 9s, but if you plan an outage, that doesn't count. Okay? Customers are no longer accepting that. Okay? A lot of customers are now putting their foot down and going, when you offer us 4 9s, that is 4 9s including outages of any kind. Scheduled, patching, updating, doesn't matter. If you cause us an outage, that's time counted in the SLA. Okay? So the customers are really starting to drive a big change in the way SLA calculations are made. Okay? Some of you may incorporate all outages in your SLAs, but we found that over the last few years when we've gone through this process, a lot of service providers always have that exclamation mark or asterisk next to the SLA times that says down in fine print, excluding planned outages. So when you start thinking about, can I achieve 56 minutes of downtime in a year, including patching time, you really start have to think about what your design looks like and how you can achieve that. So when we start looking at that, we start looking at some of the deployment options you have to meet those SLAs. And we're talking about patching your platform. We're not talking about updates on the inside the customer's VMs. We're talking about you as a service provider delivering the platform that their VMs run on, okay? Uptimes and patching of their guest VMs will decide to be dictated by what applications they run and if they got multiple servers and a whole heap of other design scenarios. But when we look at your platform that we're running at the hypervisor layer, you need to think about 99%, you can probably get away with a physical server, backup, restore, you'll probably meet your 99% uptime for SLAs. When we look at 99.9%, we're talking about being able to probably get away with Hyper-V replica, where we have our production VM, it's replicated to another server in the same data center or a DR site, and then we fail over, and that failover could take minutes or seconds to fail over, depending on DNS and a few other things. But we could achieve three nines with Hyper-V replication. 4.9s, we're talking about a Hyper-V cluster with failover server file server clusters for SMB shares or an SMB 3 pushed by a SAN. So when you really look at 4.9s and 5.9s, the technology we use is still failover clustering. CSVs or SMB shares, or a traditional SAN attachment with iSCSI. We're also talking about numbers of servers, though. Okay? When you look at your cluster, how many spare servers have you got in that cluster? Are you running all your servers in that cluster at 50% utilization, 80% utilization, 90% utilization? Do you have a server that's sitting there doing nothing? Do you have two servers sitting there doing nothing? How many N pluses are you going to have in that cluster? Okay? That's what really is going to determine 4959 type environments. Okay? If you don't have those spare servers sitting there, or servers that are running at like 20% utilization across the cluster, it's going to be harder to meet those 4.59s that you're trying to achieve. And it also comes down to things that you need to think about is, am I better having a 16-node cluster or 2 8-node clusters, which gives me a little bit more flexibility because I have 2 isolated clusters. So if one cluster goes down, I don't have to worry about the other one. Okay? I've still got a cluster up that has VMs running that I could shift other VMs to if I had to. Okay? You need to start thinking about those design principles when you're looking at your cluster designs and meeting your SLA agreements. So I'm going to jump out to a demonstration of Hyper-V Replica. And Craig tells me that he's turned off the Wi-Fi now, so we shouldn't be going across the Wi-Fi. Okay, so I'm on demo machine 1. So to do Hyper-V replication, what we do is we go into Hyper-V settings. There's a replication configuration tab, which I'm going to show you now. Okay, there is a replication configuration option. So as you can see here, we have a tick box that says enable this computer as a replica server. We have authentication and ports. In this environment where I'm replicating between my local machines here, I'm going to use Kerberos authentication over port 80. Okay? Don't recommend anyone else does it in production. Okay? This is purely a demonstration environment. In your lab, you're going to use SSL-based certificates. As we come down, you can see down here, we have authorization and storage. I'm going to allow replication from any authenticated server. So I've got an AD, all my nodes are in the AD, therefore I trust the other server. Otherwise, you could go in and, if you're using SSL certificates, you would specify the servers you want to allow to replicate to and from that server. And if I scroll down, you can see that that box is down there. So I've got all that configured, so let's hit OK. So I'm going to replicate this tenant to VM1. So we're going to go to enable replication. Next, the replica server. So I specify the server I want to replicate this VM to. So let's go to demo 2. We click next. The replica server comes up. The replication server port comes up that I'm going to replicate to. We're using a Kerberos authentication. And I've got the tick box ticked for compress the data that is transmitted over the network. Okay? Remember, if you do compression, there will be a bit of a CPU overhead utilized on the host. If you turn compression off, it won't use as much CPU and RAM. So if your server's got heaps of available RAM and CPU, it doesn't really matter. But if you're getting critically low, you may want to drop that off. I can specify the virtual disks that I want to replicate. In this VM, it's only got one disk. But if I had two disks or three disks and I had a page disk, for example, I may not want to replicate the paged VHDX file. Okay? May just want to replicate just the contents that we need in a DR scenario. Choose the frequency that you want to replicate. I'm just going to leave this at 5 minutes. If it was really critical, I could set it at 30 seconds or 15 minutes. It's up to you what you want to set that to. We also have an option here where we can maintain additional recovery points. Okay? So instead of just having one replica, okay, I could have multiple instances. Okay? So I could say create additional hourly recovery points for a period of 24 hours. So that means over a 24-hour period, I have 24 copies of the server that I could roll back to. So all of a sudden, I've actually got a backup solution as well. How many of you could instantly fail over to a replica of a server today that is 5 seconds or 30 seconds behind your production server? Instantly. Like we're talking within like under 5 seconds. That's what we can deliver with Hyper-V Replica. You can fail over to either a server in the same data center or to a DR site, and that server is live and functional within seconds. So when we go through that process, think about how many replicas do I want to keep for that customer? How critical is it? What SLA do I need to meet for that customer? We also have another nice little feature. So for those that have got large VMs and you're trying to replicate to another data center that may only be on a 10 meg pipe or a 100 meg pipe, and you want to transfer a 200 gig VM, okay, you can actually send the initial copy to an external media source. So you could plug in a USB drive if you wanted to, do the initial sync to that drive, then get one of your engineers to drive or send it via courier to your other data center. Once it's in that data center, plug it in. You configure the replication to occur off the disk onto that server, and then it'll just do a delta sync of whatever's changed in the time it took you to send the disk to that other location. Another good thought of the process for this, and one that I tell my customers to think about, is you can use Hyper-V Replica to onboard customers from their premise into your data center. You can have them use Hyper-V Replica from their server to your server. You sync. Once the servers are fully synchronized, you initiate a failover, and then the server is in production in your data center. There is very little outage to the customer, if any. The most biggest outage you're probably going to have is DNS if there's an external DNS record that needs to be changed. So we have multiple different options there for the use of Hyper-V Replica. And that's what I mean when we go through the process of the technologies we talk about today and tomorrow, how can we use these technologies for other solutions? So one of the other things we're going to do is go next. So, sorry, we're going to start the replication immediately. I'm not going to schedule it, but you could schedule it if you want to. We get a confirmation box that shows the replica server, the server port, compression, yes or no, the authentication type, frequency times, and using the network and starting immediately. So we're going to confirm all of that and hit finish. And you can now see that we're sending the initial replication data. So if I zoom in, you'll be able to see that. I now have tenant 2, VM1, is sending the initial replica. If I go to demo 2 in my Hyper-V manager, I can see that VM now exists on that Hyper-V server, and it's now receiving the changes. Okay? So it's flowing along. That's going to take a little while. We're at 33%. It's still clicking up. But down the bottom here, you'll also notice there is a replication tab. Okay? And down here on that replication tab, we can see the replication mode is a replica. We're pending initial replication. The replication health is showing a warning because we're still synchronizing. It shows the primary server, I'm the replica server, and last synchronized that is not applicable because we haven't finished the first sync. So we're at 65%, it's almost there. So once that's initially synced, which we're almost there now, once the synchronization's occurred, you can then instantly start failover if you had to. Okay? This initial synchronization, once it's occurred, we can also do a test failover. Okay? A test failover is where we fail over to the secondary copy of the server, okay? But we don't put it on the production network. You can configure a test network so when you fail over in test mode, you can test the DR, but it's not going to affect the production servers. The server comes online, it has an IP address on your test network, okay? Your client can connect to that on a new IP address and things like that, and you can fully test DR failover without having to take the production server offline. So what happens during the replication process is that when we do a test failover, the replication is put on hold. Okay? When the replication is, when you finish testing, it goes back into full replication mode and the synchronization will pick up whatever's changed during that process. But if you look at the processes that we have in place, and that's completed now, but if I was to have three copies of my VM, the production one, a secondary site, and a DR site, what I would normally recommend is that you would stop the replication to the DR site, test the DR, and you still have a secondary copy sitting somewhere. Okay? So if you're going to do DR testing, it may be worth putting in another replica of the server and use that one instead of the secondary copy. So maybe start a tertiary copy and do your DR testing on that if it's critical that you capture any changes during that testing phase. So that's finished. So we have replication. So on the VM, I can go to replication. I can fail over, test fail over, pause the replication, extend the replication period. I can view the replication health or remove replication. Okay? So if you really wanted to, if you've got a customer that you've onboarded by using Hyper-V Replica and they no longer want to replicate between the two sites, okay, you can disable the replication and you will have the server running on your environment. And you're fully functional, there's no more replication back and forth. And on demo one, you can see if I go to replication, we have less options, okay? On the server that's the primary replication server, all we can do is to do a planned failover, pause or view replication, or remove replication. On the node that is the replica of the primary, we have more options because that's where, if there's a DR scenario, that's where we're going to initialize the active go live process. So we can also come into settings on that server. And this is the replica of on the demo 2 server. So this isn't the production one, this is the replica. I can expand network adapter. And I'll show you right now. I'll zoom in so you can see it on the screen. I've gone to failover TCP/IP. So if I wanted this VM, when I fail over, to start with a different IP address, this is where I'd input that information. Okay? We can also have the test failover section, where I can also go to the virtual switch and pick the virtual network I want to use when I do a test failover. Okay, so if I created that test network, this is where I'd configure that. So that pretty much wraps up the replica demo. But again, I'll just show you one last setting. where you can see the recovery points, how often we're doing it, and everything else. So once you have created it, you can go into the settings and change it or see what settings have been configured. Okay, now questions. So registering the DNS change for the IP, when you activate that server, you would expect that it will register with AD with a new IP address. It will be done automatically. So when you boot that server, okay, so when you fail over, that Windows server is going to start up, it's going to have a new IP address, it will go and register with Active Directory and say, this is my new IP address, etc. The only issue you have is if it's a web server and it has external coming in and you've got two different data centers, you need to either have global IPs or there's going to be an outage window while you're waiting for DNS to change the external IP address. Okay, but internally in your data center, it should be fairly instantaneous. Sorry, what was the question?
If there's a network outage between cluster nodes within an IPv cluster, so the host itself, they are still living, but they cannot see each other. So split brain scenario. For example, you have a cluster spanning multiple blade centers or something like that, and they cannot see each other. What will happen and what should I do about
it? So this comes down to your... So the question is, what happens if I have multiple Hyper-V hosts, and for some reason, some of the hosts can't communicate with each other. What happens to the cluster? Which ones go offline? Which ones stay up? The answer is depending on your quorum design. Okay?
Why does it go down at all?
So the issue you have is the system doesn't go down. What occurs is the system doesn't know which owners are being own the cluster. Okay? So what happens is it starts to look at the vote process, okay? If you have three servers that can still talk together and you've got two servers in the other area that can't talk to the other three but can talk to each other, those two servers will go offline. If you have a quorum model where you're just relying on the votes, that is the scenario. That is why we recommend that you have a quorum model where you have a third site where it will be able to communicate with all servers no matter what happens. This comes down to your quorum design and your architecture with network and redundancy. Okay? The only time we ever see split brain is when customers haven't designed the cluster technology correctly. Okay? If you do the proper research and design on your quorum models, on your network connectivity, so you should never have one network that your cluster communicates on. You should always have a redundant network that your cluster can communicate on. Okay? If you only have one and that cluster communication network goes down, all your servers aren't going to be able to talk. That's why we always recommend a secondary cluster network. Having a third location or an odd number of servers always guarantees that you're going to be able to have enough votes to keep the cluster up. Okay? So it all comes down to communication between your nodes. They need to be able to see each other or see the quorum.
Never mind, that's what I was going to say. All right, so I'll ask it anyway. Is multiple networks as important anymore when you've got shared quorum?
So the question is the multiple networks important now that we can have a shared quorum disk? Personally, I still believe you need to have multiple networks for the cluster, okay? If that shared disk goes offline for whatever reason, so for example, the volume or the disk shelf that hosts that quorum disk that's shared, if that goes offline, you're in that same sort of scenario again. So if you lost that quorum disk and one of your nodes, how are you going to keep the quorum balanced? Okay, so I still recommend you have a secondary network. Okay, a lot of customers, you'll have a backup network and you'll have your cluster network and a live migration network. You would normally have enough networks to be able to have two or three use cluster communication, okay? On your backup network, running the cluster communication over your backup network isn't going to impact that greatly on the traffic going back and forth or your live migration network. Okay, so one of the questions, the question was, on the slide we're talking about automatic failover for Hyper-V replica, but when we do the demo, we show that it's a manual process. How do we do that automatic failover? So there's a couple of things. When we talk about automatic failover, we're talking about not having to do a restoration or a process, okay? There's a couple of ways we can automate the failover. One is you can give customers access to an Azure cloud service where they can initiate a failover, okay? We're not talking about the Hyper-V host automatically detecting that one's out and one's up and it automatically coming online, because you wouldn't want in a DR scenario that to occur, okay? If you had a server that automatically said, oh, I can't communicate to the primary, so I'm just going to go live, you could be causing issues because there may not actually be an outage. It may just be that that server's lost network or something. So when we talk about automatic failover with Hyper-V Replica, we're talking about ways that we can make it so that an admin doesn't have to go to Hyper-V Manager on one of the nodes, go failover. So there's two options. One is an Azure cloud service where a customer can log into a website, tick the box to failover, and the other server automatically comes online. Or we could set up monitoring on the boxes. If one goes offline, we can then bring it on and automate it. Okay? So it's not automatic failover like a cluster. Okay? We're talking about just automatically managing that failover process. If it was a cluster failover, that would be a bit scary. Is the changing of the IP address available on Linux computers? I believe it is, depending on the Linux OS. Okay? If it's a Linux-supported OS, it should change the IP address. If it's not a supported Linux OS, then no. Okay? Because some of the Linux OSs, if it's an older version, okay, it won't have all the bits that it needs. If it's one of the newer flavors, then it should. Sorry? Is it possible to run scripts after it fails over? Yeah, it is. So if a customer has a VM that fails over and for whatever reason we can't update the IP or you need to do other tasks, we can execute scripts against it. Okay, so the question is, if I've got multiple servers replicating, can I dictate which order they come up in? So if I've got a domain controller that I'm replicating between sites and an Exchange server or something, and you want the domain first and then the other servers, yep. So the replica failover is a manual process, okay? So you have to initialize that failover of each VM, okay? So you would just dictate that you want the domain controller to fail over. Then you would want the next one. You can automate that. So we can use Ops Manager, monitor the environment. And if we detect that there's a major outage, we can have Orchestrator go and initiate that failover for you, and we can get Orchestrator to do it in a specific order.